You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. I want to welcome Erik Melander. He's a professor at the Department of Peace and Conflict Research. He's also the director of the Alva Myrdal Center for Nuclear Disarmament from Uppsala University. Välkommen, Erik.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, you have a special interest in understanding violence as a perceived element of the idealized male identity. What made you interested in this area?
Well, first I became interested in looking for this kind of explanation or understanding of a pattern in social science data that I read about in an article. So I read an article that said that more gender equal societies are less likely to experience war. And I thought that was fascinating, and I started to think about why are more gender equal societies more peaceful in this sense? And that's when I started to read about the influence of various ideals of masculinity and so on. And perhaps I was also a little bit receptive to this kind of argument, because I've been interested in the Viking period, in the Viking age, and I'm not an expert in that, but according to some historians that I read, Viking society was an extreme honor culture, in the sense that men were heavily influenced by these kinds of masculine warrior ideals. So I saw a connection there, and then I started to see it everywhere. I think you can see elements of this in all societies and all around us.
Mm. And when you mentioned the gender equal countries, now you've also written about some of the benefits in your articles.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we find, me and other colleagues who have looked into this, find a robust finding that more gender equal societies are less likely to experience war and armed conflict with other states, as I mentioned, but also they are more peaceful, less violent internally. So societies with more respect for women's rights and more gender equality are also more likely to respect other rights and human rights in general. And there are fewer instances of political violence, like assassinations and uprisings, rebellions, and even civil wars within. So societies are both more peaceful internally and externally if they are more gender equal. It is one of the stronger findings in peace and conflict research.
You have experience also as an officer in Bosnia back in 1996, and your role was then as an interpreter. Now, how did the conflict impact your identity as a man?
I think it was a formative experience in many ways to be a peacekeeper in Bosnia. I'm not sure that my identity as a man was influenced so much. I guess it was, but I wasn't thinking about it. I wasn't so much aware of these arguments and so on at that time. But what I noticed and what I also thought about afterwards is that I experienced a sense of being a warrior, which was strong and impactful. So my identity as some kind of warrior or potential warrior was shaped by that experience. I had done compulsory military service before that, a couple of years earlier, since we have conscription in Sweden, and that was also, of course, a very special time in life. But this, when serving as a peacekeeper, it felt much more real, and as this was the real thing. It was serious, and I remember feeling almost in a little bit scary way. I felt empowered. I felt powerful with my weapons when we were going on patrol and so on, and knowing that we have live ammunition and we might use the weapons. We have a mandate to use them. And things happened. It was not war, but there were incidents and things happened. And that was a very special experience. And to some extent, I think I can understand the attractiveness of the warrior role and that context and way of life. So that is something that I often think about when reading theoretical literature, perhaps years afterwards.
Now, you gave an interesting talk in 2022 that, you know, it's in Swedish that you can find out on YouTube. And the English title is called Distorted Masculinity Ideals and War. Now, it would be great if you could provide a brief explanation of what you mean by distorted masculinity ideals and war. Because what I'm also found was interesting, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I understood it that you also believe that there is a time for lawful and legitimate use of violence.
Yes. Everyone who is not a radical pacifist, I think, would agree that in some circumstances, violence is justified. So if you're a radical pacifist, then you should always turn the other cheek, and violence is never justified. But for all others, there are instances when violence is justified. And for example, in Sweden, we have, through our democratic institutions, decided that we could have both an armed police force and of course, a military defense. So I think that violence can be justified for self-defense and for helping others, perhaps to resist oppression. Of course, those justifications can blend into hypocrisy and trying to justify wars of aggression and so on. But in principle, I think that violence can be justified, and that we need the way the world is. We here in Sweden, we need armed forces. And the title of that talk it brings attention to the problematic influence of certain kinds of ideals of masculinity that we have identified in our own research and, of course, by many others, that people who embrace certain ideals of masculinity are more likely to support wars of aggression and to support torture, and are more intolerant and more racist, more likely to commit violent crimes, more likely to participate in armed movements, and so on. So we identified this as a person-level variable, a thing that is different from person to person. So it's not like everybody who comes from, say, the same culture or the same ethnic group or something like that, that they are the same in this regard. But rather, it is different from person to person. And that is also why I talk about distorted ideals, because what I'm saying is not that everything that we traditionally associate with manliness or manhood necessarily is bad. And it's kind of criticizing men in general, but rather we are focusing on this particular type of masculinity, which is destructive.
What impact, now when you mentioned the culture and the background of children, and I'm thinking of male children's backgrounds and culture, including schooling, what sort of impact has that on the development of violent and aggressive male identity?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think to answer that question, we need contributions from many different scholarly disciplines and many, many studies, of course. I think that there are macro level explanations and individual level explanations, a whole range of different things that matter. Culture matters, I think, because although this is an individual level thing, how much a person embraces certain ideals and how a person then relates to other people around, that is an individual level thing. But of course, if you aggregate up many individual attitudes and behaviors, then you get culture and patterns that are lasting over time. Although, I mean, of course, they change over time. But it is important that there is a lot of variation within cultures. But nevertheless, some cultures, of course, have more of this destructive type of masculine ideals than other cultures, and it also changes over time. I mentioned the examples with the Vikings, which is an example of how people living in Scandinavia have changed dramatically in this regard. So culture is one thing, but then how a boy is treated. In one of our studies, we find that boys who were exposed to violence when growing up, so they were themselves beaten, or they saw their mother being beaten when growing up, they were later in life as adults more likely to join a violent political movement. So that's one example of the treatment that a boy is exposed to when growing up in terms of violence. And of course, how the parents relate to each other, they are like the first model for a child. So if the husband or father dominates the mother violently, then that's a model that is presented to the child. So it is learned. It can be this violent behavior and the violent attitudes can, of course, be learned in that way. It is even likely that there is some genetic component to this, that there's a tendency or propensity to be more violent and aggressive that can be inherited to some extent. But I think it's clearly that influences from upbringing and family and surroundings and culture matter a lot, matter more. Also peer influence. So parents can do so much, but peers, friends in school and the people who are dominant in school and later in youth gangs and throughout life, although people are more, it's most, more possible to shape people when they are young, I think we are also influenced throughout life. And the kind of behaviors that are rewarded and give status, those we will continue with and do more of. But we can also change if a certain set of attitudes and behaviors are not rewarded anymore, then we can learn and change.
Mm. Can you explain what you mean by young men syndrome and how this plays out in our societies?
Yeah, this is a concept. I think it comes originally from criminology, and it is based on a statistical understanding that so much of all violence in any society is perpetrated by men, and especially young men. So young men are responsible for perpetrating the overwhelming majority of all physical violence and especially lethal violence. And then it is also striking that in any society, of course, the exact numbers will change, but the tendency is very similar in most societies or all societies that have been examined, as far as I know, that among young men, there is a very small percentage that in turn is responsible for a large majority of the violent crimes. So again, this shows that there is something about maleness that drives violence. But this thing, whatever it is, applies to some men much more than to other men. And I think that this fits then very well with the explanation that it has to do with ideals of manliness. And there are also many studies that have looked at this relationship between what kind of ideals that men support or embrace, and their behavior and attitudes in various regard, as I mentioned before. There is a connection to perpetration of crime, especially violent crime and sexual violence, intimate partner violence, and so on. There is also a relationship to violent attitudes like support for torture, racism and intolerance, and so on. So it is a syndrome in the sense that young men, and especially a small group of young men, perpetrate the large part of all physical violence in any society. And it also seems to be linked to these specific ideals of manhood that emphasize that men need to be tough and fierce and violent and not back down when challenged and not showing weakness and so on.
Now, I know you stated that most violent acts, particularly violence against women, can be explained by how the child experience, how the father acts towards the mother in their home. Is there any other explanations that you can? I mean, there are also children who are brought up where fathers don't hit women, and yet the child turns into using violence against women when he becomes older.
Yeah, and this is not my specialization, but I can imagine that there are many influences. So
yep.
The model that the father provided is one, but then there is influence from peers, from culture in general, from maybe from what kind of movies one watches, what kind of pornography one watches, perhaps. I think peer influence in a gang, for example, how to gain status and respect in a certain gang, that might be associated with violence. And in certain, this vary, of course, from different contexts, but in some contexts, I think men must dominate women in their, I mean, they must dominate their women, so to speak, the women in their family, their girlfriends. And if they don't do that, they will lose respect to their peers in that gang or in that social context. So there are many, many influences.
What sort of solutions are there to stop the violence against women?
Well, I think that the most immediate thing is to put perpetrators in jail. And then once they are locked up, they can be provided with training programs and so on that might help them to adapt and behave in a more, behave better when they get out. But providing resources then to police and to courts and so on to make sure that perpetrators are brought to justice, I think, is the first and main thing. But then, of course, there are more preventive things that are equally important, but perhaps in the more medium term and long term. Providing ways out for women so that women don't have to stay in dangerous relationships, and so that they can break out from a family situation which is threatening and destructive, by supporting maybe shelters and by providing legal support to women who want to report a crime like this or who want to have a divorce, for example. So social workers that are working on helping women, of course, must be very important in this regard. But in general, I think that society, through various means, needs to demonstrate that this lifestyle, this attitude, these ideals don't work. They will, and you will end up in jail. You will not be able to dominate women around you, and you will not be able to perhaps engage in crime and buy expensive cars and watches and so on. But rather, it is a lifestyle, and it is a set of ideals that are not functioning in our society. And if we demonstrate that in various ways, then these ideals will be much less attractive, I think. Well, I think the solution is simple in the sense that we must demonstrate that this lifestyle and this set of attitudes do not work. They will not give you status and respect, but you will be a loser who is locked up in prison, and then you can change perhaps. I think that's the main thing. But of course, working on the ideals, in trying, so that is kind of a demonstration effect. But working on the ideals, I think, is also very important. But it's much, I think, much more long term, like promoting sound values of gender equality and respect and all that from early childhood in schools and in the rest of society. I think that is very important too. But that is perhaps a thing that has an effect in the medium term and long term.
Hmm. You've written about the relationship between armed violence and patriarchal values. Can you explain what you mean, and specifically, what patriarchal values do you refer to?
Yeah, so it turns out that patriarchal values, meaning the idea that there is a fundamental binary or fundamental difference between men and women, and men are basically superior and have a right to privileges in family and in society and in politics. That's a basic element that recurs in these different variations of different types of masculinity that is linked to violence and violent attitudes. Sometimes we also talk about the element of honor ideology, meaning that an additional set of attitudes that emphasize that men must never back down when challenged, because then they will lose status and respect. So men must be fierce and tough and dominate other men. So that is like an additional element. And there are also other elements that are sometimes added. So it's like a set of attitudes that partially overlap.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about the current conflict we have, or war we have here in Europe between Russia and Ukraine, what do you think that is based on? And is there some kind of resolution to that conflict?
Yeah, that is a very big question, an important one. I think there are many reasons behind this war, and a lot of it has to do with the power calculations of a small circle around Russian President Vladimir Putin. But I think there are underlying social forces that help drive the war and make it possible. I mean, there's Russia is an authoritarian system, and what Putin decides, that is basically what is going to happen, even though there are restrictions as well, of course. But it makes it possible for him to launch this kind of war, in part because there are widespread attitudes in the population that favor war and violence. Ideas about that Russia has a rightful position of dominance vis-a-vis surrounding peoples, and that Ukrainians are not Ukraine is not a real nationality, but they are somehow inferior Russians. So lots of attitudes like that, and also related to what we talked about before, ideas that real, just like Russia needs to dominate surroundings, real men need to dominate women and be dominant in society. And of course, the ultimate man, the ultimate dominant man, is Putin, who is portrayed as this macho man who is physically strong and who makes all the decisions and so on. And Putin, in turn, plays upon this consciously by trying to portray Russia as defenders of traditional family roles and traditional gender roles against the dangerous influences from the West, like ideas about trans rights and people who are homosexual can marry and things like that, that he then portrays as foreign dangerous influences that pure Russia must withstand. And then again, that becomes a way of mobilizing people for war and violence. I think in the short term, the solution will have to involve supporting Ukraine and kind of containing Russia in the sense that other countries may also need support and protection, like Moldova, for example. But in the long term, in order to have real peace, there must be a change in the political institutions, of course, a democratization, a genuine democratization, and also in the norms and values, including these ideals of masculinity and also these imperialistic views on other peoples. These things must also change in order to have a piece of high quality, and that will take a long time.
Mm-hmm. Can you think about anything you want to add to what you have talked about? Maybe something that I haven't asked?
Maybe that to stress that we who focus on these types of masculinities and the negative effects they have, we are not kind of blaming all men or saying that it is bad to be a man or that all the traditional things associated with men and manhood are bad or should not be engaged in and so on. That's one thing. And the other thing perhaps is to, when thinking about, you talked about legitimate violence before, and that in Sweden, for example, we have, as most countries, we have a military. So when traditionally militaries have been very much influenced by this kind of masculinity, and it is sometimes referred to as militarized or military masculinity. And for modern societies, that's not what we want to shape our soldiers and officers. We want to have other ideals, but we also want to have a strong military, because that's the point of it. And then we need to preserve some of these ideals that have been valorized in traditional militarized masculinity, like hardiness, strength, bravery, and so on. But we need to de-link those ideals from conceptions of masculinity, I think. Because otherwise, these ideas of domination and privileges and a lot of excessive violence will come along as a luggage or baggage that comes with militarized masculinity. So the challenge for a modern progressive state is to train soldiers and develop a military which is functioning and efficient and democratic and not based on these negative conceptions of masculinity. And I think Sweden is working on that a lot with our values that are emphasized in the armed forces, and the commander-in-chief marches in the Pride parade in Stockholm Pride every year, and sings and dances, and a lot of people find that, or some people find that ridiculous or bad, but I think it's an important symbolic gesture in this work to de-link the military from negative forms of masculinity.
And one final question now, when you were talking about the military, what role do women have in the military?
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally, it shouldn't matter if people are men or women or intersex or trans or whatever. The military should only care about if people are motivated, if they want to join, and if they have the capacities and skills that are needed. But that's an ideal, and I don't think any military in the world has reached that. But generally, the military should be better, not only in the sense that people are less likely to be harassed and discriminated against and so on, but also better in the sense of being more efficient. If people are able to join and to make a career without any arbitrary limitations like gender or sexual identity or anything like that, because then you have a broader pool of recruitment. You can find those who are most suitable for different jobs without excluding anyone in advance, and that is an ideal, I think, for a modern military, to have the broadest possible recruitment pool and to then promote those who turn out to be the most suitable without any discrimination. So women can have a very prominent role in the military. In Sweden, for example, and in most countries, the number of women in the armed forces is increasing. But it is far from an equal place in terms of numbers between men and women. And maybe it never will be. At least nobody should be discriminated against or harassed and so on.
Thank you so much, Erik Melander, for sharing with us your amazing experiences and valuable knowledge about this enormously important area. And I hope I can invite you back later for another conversation.
Thank you. I'm very thankful for this opportunity to talk about this research by myself and my colleagues and, of course, many others. And I'd be happy to have another conversation at some time.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.